This is an ABC podcast.
Afternoon, welcome to The World Today. I'm Thomas Ariti. Coming up this Thursday, the latest unemployment figures. They're not great, but not as bad as many thought they could be. We'll have the latest. And could falls in property prices change the way we look at real estate and where we live? We'll delve into a possible upside to the changes brought by the coronavirus crisis.
I think people having time on their side to reflect on, I guess, the challenges and stresses with life, and also the fact, you know, the remote workplace coming into effect and having, you know, a positive impact, I feel, where people are thinking, well, you know what, I don't really need to live, you know, 10 minutes from work.
First to those numbers, and after weeks of warnings to expect some bad economic news from the pandemic, this lunchtime it's official. Australia's unemployment rate has surged to 6.2% as COVID-19 sends an earthquake through the jobs market. As usual, the ABC senior business correspondent Peter Ryan has been trawling through a sobering set of numbers. He joins me live now. Afternoon, Pete. I guess, first of all, take us through those numbers.
Good afternoon, Tom. At 6.2%, it is a huge number. It's very significant, and there are real human costs here. But it's not the 8.3% that economists had been expecting. There had been forecasts of the worst jobless rate since the Asian financial crisis in 1998 of 8%, maybe even something as bad as the 1990s recession. But there's still a big surge from 5.2% in March. It's up a full percentage point in April. And remember that March didn't cover those lines of people or sacked workers standing outside Centrelink offices that we all saw. But the April numbers do illustrate the devastating impact on Australia's economy because of the lockdown and the distancing rules. So on jobs lost in April, that's higher than expected at 594,300. And the participation rate is lower at 63.5%. That's perhaps demonstrating the shock and fewer people looking for work. And as we've seen with job ads in newspapers and on the internet collapsing, the Bureau of Statistics says 489,000 people actually left the workforce, so they're not counted. And the big focus for economists now won't be the actual jobless rate, but the number of hours worked and, of course, underemployment. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, had been predicting a brutal number, and just after the confirmation of the unemployment surge hit, he spoke and said this might not be the end.
This is a tough day for Australia, a very tough day. Almost 600,000 jobs has been lost, every one of them. Devastating for those Australians, for their families, for their communities. A very tough day. Terribly shocking, although not unanticipated.
The Prime Minister Scott Morrison, Peter Ryan's with me. Peter, these numbers are bad enough on their own, but they also mask the reality and that buffer provided by the JobKeeper payment. So what happens when that program disappears?
Well, Tom, that's right. The $130 billion JobKeeper program, that's $1,500 a fortnight to each eligible employee, is the bulk of the federal government's $320 billion emergency rescue package. But these workers aren't counted in the official survey by the ABS, even though they're working 0 hours a week. So the reality of the April jobless surge is much worse, and some economists say maybe the real jobless rate is perhaps in the low double digits. The JobKeeper payments are meant to end in late September, which means for some businesses there will be a cliff and there'll be pressure for an extension, given that not all businesses will be back, even if the restrictions are fully lifted. The Australian National University economist Bruce Chapman, who developed the HECS scheme for university students, has suggested a similar program so business can still get access to those funds but at low rates to tide them over to avoid that cliff.
And briefly, Peter, has the opposition said anything about the numbers so far?
So the opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, was out shortly before the Prime Minister, and here's what he had to say.
Their family and their kids, they're people who are our friends, our relatives, our neighbours, people in our community. They're people also who won't be receiving the sort of income that you get in work, which then helps stimulate the economy. And that's the problem here.
The opposition leader Anthony Albanese and Peter Ryan before that, thank you. Well, while 10,000 workers at Virgin Australia and 12,000 creditors watch and wait for that news about their futures, a political brawl's broken out between Canberra and Brisbane. After the federal government rejected a plea to bail the airline out last month, the Queensland government's indicating it might step in to buy a stake via its independent investment arm. But some in the federal government are now criticising that move as a brain fart and crazy. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon.
Bids are due tomorrow for the ailing airline, which is in administration after crumbling under the weight of a $7 billion debt bill, with half of the Brisbane-based operator's 10,000 staff in Queensland. Anastasia Palaszczuk's state government says it'll enter the fray to try and buy the airline. Cameron Dick was appointed her treasurer earlier this week.
There are a lot of business interests circling the company. Some of them aren't necessarily going to put Queensland's interests first, and that's why I have to initiate this project to ensure Queensland's interest can be protected the best it can.
Queensland-based federal politicians are less than impressed. Agriculture Minister David Littleproud's calling the move a brain fart. Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton's calling it crazy and tying it to the state election due in October.
Anastasia Palaszczuk has brought Queensland to the brink of bankruptcy, and she's now talking about buying an airline. I mean, it's dangerous. And if it's a political stunt, they should pull out of it now.
And he's offering more free political advice if the state government goes ahead with its bid.
And they need to be honest that the money that they're going to use, at least in part, apart from further borrowings, will be the superannuation funds of nurses and police in Queensland. Now, is that a prudent way in which to invest your superannuation money? I don't think so.
That comes after the Prime Minister just last month urged the Transport Workers Union Superannuation Fund to invest in the airline. State Treasurer Cameron Dix retaliating against Mr Dutton's attack.
He's got enough trouble with cruise ships. That's the form of transport he needs to worry about.
That's a reference to the Ruby Princess debacle, which Labor says is Mr Dutton's fault. Mr Dix says his only focus is keeping the airline in the skies for when the virus emergency passes.
Graham Sangmore, former head of the ACCC, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, who has said quite clearly today, we need a second airline. We need a second airline in this company, whatever form it takes, and I'm not going to take lectures from Peter Dutton.
Caught in the middle of the slanging match is the Federal Transport Minister, Michael McCormack.
I'll let them have their little discussions between themselves. So as the Portfolio Minister, I'll just say we've got 24 or so hours left before those preliminary bids can go in. Let's see what happens. I want to see two commercially viable airlines. I think that's so important for commuters, so important for the thousands of workers that Virgin employs.
But he's also making it clear that he'd prefer to see a fully commercial winner emerge from the 20 or so bidders expected to make a play for the airline.
They're a government, and I agree with Deb Frecklington. They should stick to trying to run Queensland and Queensland's economy. I think this should be left to companies. Should be left to potential bidders and investors who aren't necessarily government.
Transport Minister Michael McCormack and Tom Eagledon with that report. On ABC Radio, across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app. This is The World Today. Thanks very much for your company. You can find all of our stories on the show's website. Just search for The World Today and you can also subscribe to our podcast. Well, we know that the property market has been hit hard and sales of new homes in Australia have fallen to their lowest levels on record, adding to fears there'll be a coronavirus house price crash. A survey of the 100 biggest home builders in the country has found that the restrictions have seen consumers cancel sales at a rate four times higher than during the 2008 global financial crisis. For more on this unfolding story, business reporter David Taylor joins me now. Afternoon, Dave. Can I ask you about this first? Yesterday, the Commonwealth Bank warned there was an outside chance at best of a 30% crash in property prices. Now, does this latest data increase those chances?
Oh, g'day, Tom. Look, it's a distinct possibility. We can't rule it out. The Housing Industry Association says that sales of new homes in Australia have fallen to their lowest levels on record. Now, it says there's been a 23% drop since the coronavirus pandemic struck in February. Now, it shows that activity's fallen off a cliff, but it opens up the possibility of big moves in the market. When there's less activity, you get big price movements. Now, add a recession to that mix, and there's the potential, obviously, for big falls. So the CBA is saying there's a potential 30% house price crash it's interesting that it's the biggest lender in the country saying we have factored this into our models. That in itself, Tom, is significant.
David, there's always huge interest in where property prices are going, and obviously even more so now. Is that because prices are so intertwined with household wealth? And on top of that, will homeowners be in trouble if there's a property market crash?
Look, it'll depend on where you sit in the market. But for those who bought, say, 10 to 20 years ago, it's a long timeline, but they're still looking very good. They're looking at huge increases in their house price, 80% or thereabouts. Now, if you own your own home and you're ahead of your repayments, again, there's nothing to worry about. If you're not moving, you can just sit and keep repaying. But there is the possibility of negative equity or moving into negative equity where what you owe becomes a little bit more than what you've got in terms of equity. So if you bought a home and you only just scraped through in terms of your eligibility for that loan and your house price is falling significantly, then you might have a few problems.
Let's look at the other side of the equation, though. What about for aspiring homeowners? Would a property price crash make it easier for them to get into the property market?
This is a really interesting aspect of this debate, because if you ask someone who's been looking for a home for the past, say, 3 or 4 years, and they've been trying to build up a deposit and they think they might be getting somewhere, then you have prices fall 30% and you think, well, hang about, maybe I can get in. Maybe the price has fallen significantly enough that I've actually got a chance. The problem with a house price crash that's been modelled at the moment is that it comes with a recession, and with a recession comes big job losses, as we've seen today, and huge cuts to people's pay and hours. So while it sounds good on the surface, Tom, if you're young and you've lost your job, or you don't have that much income, or you're renting, it's actually going to become a lot harder. So let's just hope that for those who are looking to get into the housing market, that a crash doesn't come and it's something a little less than that.
Watch this space. Business reporter David Taylor, thank you. Well, there might be a grim outlook for Australia's property market, but it's predicted the pandemic might also bring an upside, with a wave of people choosing to make a tree or a sea change. Demographers and real estate agents say a rapid shift to working from home has released millions of Australians from that need to commute, and they're now rethinking where and how to live. Gavin Coote takes a look.
In a similar spirit to the popular 90s TV show, a sea change had been on the cards for Megan Donald for quite a while. Her husband has recovered from a tumour and remains immunocompromised, so the move 90 minutes north to the Central Coast has been brought forward.
It just happened very quickly that we found this house and within a week signed the contracts, and this was going to be our retirement place or holiday place in the meantime. But when the COVID was closing in, it seemed like a better place to be than in Sydney. So it made that decision happen a lot quicker.
The quality of life and perceived health benefits were just some of the draw cards. Megan Donald's also seen the economic upside in moving out of Australia's biggest city.
The house that we have up here, it was less than our three-bedroom squashed-in townhouse down in Sydney. So to be living up here with all this space and beautiful views and beautiful surroundings cost less for the house than it did for the townhouse down in Sydney, the current value.
Much like what the Central Coast is to Sydney, Geelong has long been an attractive spot for Melburnians who want the regional lifestyle but still want the benefits of living in a vibrant city. Geelong real estate agent Michael Lillywhite thinks the COVID-19 pandemic has only heightened the level of interest among buyers.
I think people having time on their side to reflect on, I guess, the challenges and stresses with life, and also the fact, you know, the remote workplace coming into effect and having, you know, a positive impact, I feel, where people are thinking, well, you know what, I don't really need to live, you know, 10 minutes from work.
With the massive upheaval COVID-19 is creating for society and the way Australians work, demographers like Bernard Salt are seeing the upsides.
Prior to the pandemic, barely 5% of the workforce worked from home. That proportion is now probably close to 35 or 40%. After the pandemic has passed, I think we might revert back to, say, 10%. That's a doubling of the long-term proportion of people working from home. As soon as you do that, you release people from the need to commute.
Bernard Salt says Australians will then be more free to choose exactly where they'd like to live.
It will be within a band of maybe 150, maybe 200 kilometres of the major urban centres.
But he sees a more interesting trend emerging on Australia's outer suburban fringes. Travel times on Sydney's busiest roads have dropped by about a third during the coronavirus lockdown, and the congestion that typically plagues the commuter corridors linking peri-urban areas is something Bernard Salt thinks could be less of a headache when the economy ramps back up.
And you create a very different model, and that model is a system of interconnected, self-contained regions. So you live, work, play, recreate, go to university, go to shops, all within the local area, based around Penrith, or based around Cranbourne, or based around Caboolture. The whole idea of living in the suburbs and commuting into the city centre is really, it's a very 20th century notion. It could well be in the 21st century, post the COVID experience, we're suddenly awakened to a new model that I think will most certainly strike a chord with the millennial generation.
Demographer Bernard Salt and Gavin Coote with that report. Heading to Queensland now, where a medical research team is calling for people who have recovered from COVID-19 to donate their blood so they can learn more about the body's immune response to the virus which causes the disease. And they hope this might lead to the development of treatments to fight it. Rachel Mealy has this report.
In early March, Brisbane Uni student Jaden Snowden started to feel a bit unwell.
On the Friday, I think it was, I woke up with a bit of a headache, a slight headache, and then was kind of getting migraines throughout the day. And then after that, I think kind of the weekend, just feeling a little bit lousy. So lousy enough to take work off, but not lousy enough to worry about it. So I was feeling pretty much completely fine, bar a bit of a headache and a blocked nose.
The next day, he found out that his friend had tested positive to COVID-19, and he was advised that he should get tested. It came back positive.
They sent me an ambulance. I got taken to Prince Charles isolation ward because at the time it was a really fresh, new thing. And then other than that, just the blocked nose got a little bit worse. I ended up losing my sense of taste and my sense of smell. But other than that, the headaches went away. The lousiness went away. It was just the nasal congestion after that. I didn't have anything else.
The otherwise healthy 20-year-old is a martial arts instructor and bounced back from the illness after 11 days. He's now donated a blood sample to researchers in the hope they can use it to better understand how the body responds. Dr. Corey Smith is leading the team at QIMR Berghofer Medical Research Institute. He says the focus will be on the body's T-cell or immune response.
So what we're aiming to do is to study these T-cell responses in people who've been exposed to the viruses that causes COVID-19. So what we expect is actually that, you know, these T-cells will be very important.
Dr. Smith hopes this leads to an understanding of why some people, like Jaden, are good at fighting the virus and others are not.
And we think that part of the problem, particularly for older people, is that they aren't very good at making T cell responses. So what we're aiming to do is recruit people who've recovered, study their responses to the virus, that we really fairly standard kind of things we've done in the laboratory for a long time. And then we hope we can understand a lot more about how people respond. But, you know, with the potential ultimate goal is looking at other ways, either treat patients with what we call T-cell immunotherapy, or even possibly develop ways in which we could monitor how people go when they're infected.
He says there's a critical point for people who've been diagnosed with COVID-19 around the world. About a week in, the body either gets sicker or starts to fight the illness.
One target we're aiming for in sort of 6 to 8 months is that we can use these volunteers, if we can use these volunteers to understand their immune response, we can then potentially look to actually generating T cells from these patients that we could then, you know, administer to people who are sick. So that's really our goal in the first place.
Jaden Snowden says it makes him feel good to know that his blood could make a difference.
If they can somehow find out more about the immunity or how they could develop a vaccine or something like that just from this, then yeah, absolutely, that's super significant. That'd be awesome.
Jaden Snowden, a Brisbane University student, and that report from Rachel Mealy. As we've been reporting, domestic violence is surging during the coronavirus lockdown as people spend more time together at home. Helplines are dealing with an increase in calls, and the Victorian government has released a new TV ad urging people to watch out for signs of abuse. As Samantha Donovan reports, supermarket workers already appear to be doing just that.
Supermarket staff have been praised as frontline workers during the coronavirus outbreak, stocking shelves and putting up with abuse from frustrated customers. But it seems they're also playing another crucial role, noticing customers in distress.
So some of the local supermarkets and local retail outlets, staff from there who have been noticing women who are presenting quite distressed, actually just crying in the aisles, and I'm getting phone calls or messenger conversations about if I could pop up and help or have a conversation with these women.
RMIT University's Abby Newman is one of only two social workers in the country accredited as a specialist family violence advisor. She's been getting these reports in her semi-rural community outside Geelong in Victoria. So she's been heading to supermarkets and shops to speak to women while they're away from their partners.
I'm scheduling a couple of appointments for women's big shops. So when they're going up to do a big shop for the family for the week, it gives us a lot more time to be able to have those conversations, and it's time that's not monitored and that they don't have to be accountable for when they get home. So we're having conversations about giving them language around what is actually happening and what their rights are, talking to them about how they could access legal advice if they're just at that point where they're thinking about what to do and some of their options. And then for the really high-risk women, about involving both the police and our refuge system, our domestic violence specialist systems.
Why do you think these problems are being revealed at supermarkets and other shops?
At the moment, in the context of COVID, there are only a few places that are safe for women, and one of them is the supermarket. It's a public space where often her time isn't monitored. It doesn't threaten the perpetrator's sense of control, and it means that she can have conversations, she can have a cry, she can have a couple of moments to breathe where she's not being monitored like she would be at home, and access help.
What have these women been telling you about how being stuck at home is making their situation worse?
Just feeling like they're watched from the kitchen to the bedroom, they're watched from the kitchen to the couch. They're trying to be battling that tension of his bad mood while doing things like homeschooling or working from home. They're talking to me about, I couldn't afford to go up to the supermarket and buy him a slab. I've come back, I'm terrified of going back to say we can't afford it because it's going to cause a flare-up and it's going to come back on me.
Supermarket workers are obviously picking up on some of the signs. Is there a role for the broader community if they see a woman in distress in public?
I guess for the broader community, it's not necessarily that you have to ask, are you experiencing family violence? But are you okay is a really important question. If the conversation revolves around the relationship, we're not asking people to be experts, but knowing to be able to say, well, actually, maybe you could talk to these people and that there is help available. And in the COVID climate at the moment, we need to look to where are the safe spaces that women are accessing and how do we identify and then provide them the information when they're there.
RMIT University's Abby Newman. Samantha Donovan reporting. If you're in an abusive situation or you know someone who is, call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, please call 000. As you might have heard in recent weeks, we've put the call out to musicians around the country to give us their take on the world today's closing theme. We've had some rocks and jazz, you wouldn't believe it, even some bagpipes. And you can see some videos on Twitter. Just follow me at Thomas O'Reety. That includes today's offering. It's from Josh Graham. He's based in the Blue Mountains in New South Wales, and he's working on a solo album at the moment under the name Joshua Josh. It'll be out soon. Not sure if this track will be part of the album, but we love it anyway. Thanks very much, Josh. Thanks for your company this afternoon, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Chat then. We'll be right back.
I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
So far, we've been measuring this pandemic in two ways, the number of people killed by the virus and the damage to the economy. But there is a third impact that we're only just beginning to get a sense of, and that's what it's doing to Australia's mental health.
Today on The Signal, the close link between unemployment and the suicide rate, and what steps could be taken now to prevent those deaths in the months and years to come. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.